Reciprocity of Prose and Poetry, 1983. This talk was written for and given as part of the 1983 poetry series at the Folger Shakespeare Library. Jean Nordhaus, who was running the series, needed a title to put in her flyer long before the talk was written. So I said off the top of my head, "Oh, call it Reciprocity of Prose and Poetry," figuring that reciprocity was one of those Humpty Dumpty words that can mean anything you like while sounding deeply meaningful. Unfortunately, it is not only a meaningful word, but a strong-minded one. And every time I turned a corner in the writing of my talk, there was reciprocity waiting for me with a stern expression saying, "What exactly do you mean?" People who read use the words prose and poetry with perfect confidence, and generally without trying to define them either in themselves or in contrast to each other. In this, they are probably wise. The borderline between prose and poetry is one of those fog-shrouded literary minefields where the wary explorer gets blown to bits before ever seeing anything clearly. It is full of barbed wire and the stumps of dead opinions. It has been no man's land ever since the bourgeois gentleman blundered into it in Molière's play 300 years ago. "Monsieur Jourdain, I want you to help me write a little billy-doux." The philosophy teacher: "Certainly. Would you like it to be poetry?" Monsieur Jourdain: "No, no poetry." The philosophy teacher: "Prose, then?" Monsieur Jourdain: "No, not poetry and not prose." The philosophy teacher: "It has to be one or the other." Monsieur Jourdain: "Why?" The philosophy teacher: "Well, sir, the only means of expression we possess are prose and poetry." Monsieur Jourdain: "There isn't anything besides prose and poetry?" The philosophy teacher: "Correct. Whatever is not prose is poetry, and whatever is not poetry is prose." Monsieur Jourdain: "But talking? What's talking?" The philosophy teacher: "Prose." Monsieur Jourdain: "What? You mean when I say, 'Hey, Nick, bring my slippers and get me a hot toddy,' that's prose?" The philosophy teacher: "Yes, sir." Monsieur Jourdain: "By God, I've been talking prose for 40 years and never knew it." Now, here is a remarkably similar conversation from the much-admired Random House Dictionary of the English Language, 1967. Poetry. 1. The art of rhythmical composition, written or spoken, for exciting pleasure by beautiful, imaginative, or elevated thoughts. 2. Literary work in metrical form, verse. 3. Prose with poetic qualities. Prose. 1. The ordinary form of written or spoken language, without metrical structure, as distinguished from poetry or verse. 2. Matter of fact, commonplace, dull expression. The vigorous ignorance of the bourgeois gentleman may be a better guide through the minefield than the certainties of the philosophy teacher and the dictionary. Indeed, the dictionary seems to create its own fog. Definition 1 of poetry is rather fine, but is badly undercut by definition 1 of prose, which limits rhythm to metrical structure and limits prose to being ordinary. Although things get worse in definition 2, which asserts it is dull. These definitions, when applied to cases, would unequivocally put Jane Eyre and Our Mutual Friend into the category of poetry, while excluding from it the cantos and the wasteland. Evidently, we need some devices to probe for minds with, such as a clear and practicable conception of what rhythm in language is and where it coincides with metrics. After which, we could begin to explore the vast area in which a rhythmic structure or pattern exists in language, but does not coincide with metrics. In 1917, William Patterson of Columbia University wrote a book called The Rhythm of Prose, an interesting attempt to use experiment to supplement opinion and authority, and an excellent summary of the theories and research on the subject in his day. It remains, so far as I know, the only book on the subject of prose rhythms. There is need for a book on the rhythms of literature, or artfully used language, rhythms in the largest sense, as organizing or patterning principles, and their relation to the rhythms of ordinary speech, prose in the bourgeois gentleman's sense. Fascinating studies in this latter area exist, mostly in the specialized journals of linguistics. The research of such scholars as the Dr. Scollin in Alaska on spoken rhythms is related to the work done by such scholar-poets as Del Himes and Dennis Tedlock in bringing the oral literatures of other cultures into the English ken, and, in doing so, examining the whole nature of the artful use of language. If this work could be brought together into a state-of-the-art, as Patterson did 65 years ago, it would be a very exciting book. Without it, all I can do is blunder on through the minefield. At once, I step straight onto Gertrude Stein and leap into the air. Poetry is, I say, essentially a vocabulary, just as prose is essentially not. And what is the vocabulary of which poetry absolutely is? It is a vocabulary based on the noun, as prose is essentially and determinately and vigorously not based on the noun. Poetry is concerned with using, with abusing, with losing, with wanting, with denying, with avoiding, with adoring, with replacing the noun. It is doing that, always doing that, doing that and doing nothing but that. Poetry is doing nothing but using, losing, refusing, and pleasing, and betraying, and caressing nouns. So that is poetry really loving the name of anything, and that is not prose. That is a charming hand grenade, but the pin's missing, I think. To define poetry as naming, not telling, to exclude narrative, was useful 50 years ago, 70 years ago, when poetry was ridding itself of regular meter, rhyme, and a fixed poetic diction and matter. Poetry had to be redefined as independent of verse, an independence still ignored by definition 2 of poetry and definition 1 of prose in the Random House Dictionary. Like all revolutions, this one broke down barriers indiscriminately. Like all revolutions, its acts of freedom tended to harden into dogmas. Poetry was defined not only as independent of metrical verse, but as exclusive of and superior to it, which is historically nonsense. Poetry was further defined as exclusive of narration, exposition, discussion, and drama, which is demented. The lava had hardened to basalt by the time I came to Gertrude Stein's college. She was off in Paris, happily digging holes in English prose, but in English A, we were solemnly informed that a poem must not mean, but be. Some of us wanted to ask, why? Why can't it do both, if it likes, or perhaps something else entirely? But freshmen, especially fresh women, did not ask questions like that where the Lowells spoke only to the Cabots, and you know who the Cabots spoke to. So we swallowed the dogma in class and spat it out at the door. The children of the revolution are always ungrateful. and the revolution must be grateful that it is so. Pursuing the snark of definition through the fog, one comes upon a statement by Huntington Brown that is far more cautious, specious, and dangerous than Gertrude Stein's. If it be asked wherein a poet's attitude toward his matter differs from that of a prose writer, my answer would be that, in prose, the characteristic assumption of both writer and reader is that the subject has an identity and an interest apart from the words, whereas in poetry, it is assumed that word and idea are inseparable. This one ticks. As a distinction of fantasy from realistic fiction, it would be of considerable interest. But as a distinction of poetry from prose, it is very odd. I do not think Mr. Brown meant to imply that the subject or matter of poetry is unidentifiable and of no inherent interest, though he comes very near saying so. But there is in his definition an implication that cannot be avoided and should be made clear. It is the language that counts in poetry and the ideas that count in prose. Corollary, poetry is untouchable, but prose may be freely paraphrased. This is indeed a very common assumption shared by readers and writers alike. Mr. Brown is absolutely correct in that, but I question the assumption, which he does not. The integrity of a piece of language, poetry or prose, is a function of its quality, and an essential element of its quality is the inseparability of idea and language. When a thing is said right, it is said right. Whether in prose or poetry, formal discourse or cursing the cat. If it is said wrong, if it lacks quality, if it is stupid poetry or careless prose, you may paraphrase it all you like. Chances are you will improve it. But how are word and idea to be separated in this? "What child is it?" cried several ladies at once. And among the rest, Nancy Lammeter, addressing Godfrey. "I don't know. Some poor woman's who has been found in the snow, I believe," was the answer Godfrey wrung from himself with a terrible effort. "After all, am I certain?" he hastened to add, silently, in anticipation of his own conscience. "Why, you'd better leave the child here, then, Master Marner," said good-natured Mrs. Kimball, hesitating, however, to take those dingy clothes into contact with her own ornamented satin bodice. "I'll tell one of the girls to fetch it." "No, no, I can't part with it. I can't let it go," said Silas, abruptly. "It's come to me. I've a right to keep it." The proposition to take the child from him had come to Silas quite unexpectedly. And his speech, uttered under a strong, sudden impulse, was almost like a revelation to himself. A minute before, he had no distinct intention about the child. That the subject of that passage has an identity and interest apart from the words is true, but to what degree is it genuinely separable from them? If they are separable, it should be easy to make a satisfactory paraphrase of Godfrey's curious aside, which, though set in parentheses and qualified as silent, is written as if spoken out loud, almost as if the others could hear him thinking, or as if he thought they could hear him thinking. It should be easy to write another sentence characterizing the good-natured Mrs. Kimball, who sees the clothes, not the child, touch her breast, and to rewrite Silas's speech, all broken monosyllables, and to find equally appropriate words in which to express the ideas of the final paragraph. I do not believe that any of this is easy or possible. In fact, I believe that any tampering with that passage would be as offensive as tampering with a bit of Shakespeare or Keats. And not only was the passage taken truly at random, the first novel my hand touched in the bookcase, open to the page it chose to open at, but it is a fragment out of context from a large-scale work that gains its power and the real identity and interest of its subject less from the sense and sound of any sentence or paragraph than from the pacing and rhythm of paragraphs and chapters and the shape and pace of the actions described. Large, slow movements, taking real time to read and occupying considerable psychological and intellectual space. Eliot was certainly not a great stylist like Dickens, but she wrote prose. And no paraphrase or rewrite or update or Cliff's Notes can do anything to it but weaken and destroy it. This characteristic assumption that poetry is the beautiful dumb blonde, all words, and prose is the smart brunette with glasses, all ideas, is certainly a common one. It lurks at the heart of the poem that must not mean but be, as well as in the tiny mind of the average bestseller writer. But here is somebody who I think does not share it. This is Gary Snyder, being asked by an interviewer what is the difference between his poetry and his prose. My own prose does not have the musical phrase or the rhythm behind it, nor does it have the constant density or the complexity of my poetry. I don't really think of them as different so much. I adopt whatever structure seems to be necessary to the communication in mind. And I try to keep a clear line between, say, journal jottings and poems. And again, the real line is in the music and the density. Although again, to be fair, not all my poems are that dense in terms of content analysis, but have maybe a musical density sometimes. The modesty and candor of that reply is an essential element of its meaning, I think. Snyder brings out what he thinks characterizes poetry, rhythm and density, so that one can make a kind of definition from his statement. Poetry tends to be more rhythmic and denser in texture than prose. But clearly they aren't, in his mind, all that different. The difference is of degree, not kind. For that kind of easy, laid-back attitude and for moving easily between poetry and prose, Snyder gets put down. He lacks rigor. To which I would reply, at least he isn't rigid. My concern here is personal. I also write both prose and poetry, and move freely between them. And so I'm curious to know why and how I know that I write both, and how I know that they are not the same thing. And I am interested because, although I wrote and published poetry first, my reputation was made as a prose writer. And I find my poetry quite often dismissed on the sole ground that it was written by a novelist, and so cannot be taken seriously. Are prose and poetry activities so far from being reciprocal that they are incompatible, then? Poets have to defend poetry with fierce intelligence against the dead weight and corruption of non-poetry and anti-poetry, as Sidney and Shelley did, and renew that defense in every generation. But poetry is not anti-prose, and intelligent defense is not mere territorialism. Sometimes a Westerner, like myself, even gets the impression that the territory of poetry lies east of the Mississippi. But generally it seems more like a big fish tank, and its inhabitants come rushing out of their nests of weed like sticklebacks in mating season, shouting, "Out, out, go write novels, go tell stories, go write plays and libretti and screenplays and television scripts and radio dramas and descriptions of the universe and histories and speculations on the nature of mankind and the cosmos and all that prose, But keep out of our territory, where nothing is allowed to happen except poetry, which is none of the above. In here we are poets, and we write for one another. Goethe wrote both prose and poetry, in large quantities and of indisputable quality, and he said, "Occasional poetry is the highest form." I am sure he didn't mean the kind of stuff that poet laureates emit to please the ruling classes, but a poetry that escapes the private, the confessional, and the merely esoteric by observing, in lament or celebration, in drama or description or narration or lyric, in any mode or tone, a shared occasion. Such poetry may be mysterious, but is not idiosyncratic. Its movement is outward from the individual center to the center of a larger whole, a community. That movement is the energy of all theater and of all oral literatures, performance of which, whether ritual or casual, is their own occasion. It is surely the native movement or gesture of poetry. Occasional poetry, as the highest poetry, is an idea worth keeping in mind, though it is a daunting ideal in this time of supercommunication and superweapons, when, whether we like it or not, and whether or not we like one another, all occasions include us all. At any rate, it is an idea that serves as an antidote to the defensive definition of poetry as anti-prose, a hermetic art. I'd like to see that definition neutralized, because when people take it seriously, it not only mandarinizes poetry, but narrows and lowers the expectations and standards for the writing of novels, screenplays, descriptions of baseball games and remote galaxies and so on, all of which should surely be in free communication and having intercourse in every sense of the word all the time with poetry. All the same, there is a difference, isn't there? In the work, not the worker, says Shelley. The distinction between poets and prose writers, he says in The Defense of Poetry, is a vulgar error. Now, there's a man who's swatted philosophy teachers like flies. The distinction Shelley makes is between measured and unmeasured language. For the popular division into prose and verse is inadmissible in accurate philosophy. Sounds, as well as thoughts, have relation both between each other and towards that which they represent. And a perception of the order of those relations has always been found connected with a perception of the order of the relations of thoughts. Hence, the language of poets has ever affected a certain uniform and harmonious recurrence of sound, without which it were not poetry, and which is scarcely less indispensable to the communication of its influence than the words themselves, without reference to that peculiar order. It is a difficult passage. I understand it to say that the measure, not the meter, which he specifically dismisses as accidental, the measure, what Gary Snyder calls rhythm, is the expression of the relations of sounds and of thoughts among themselves and to one another. The perception of a larger order in which sounds and ideas move together. Word music. This certainly does not, and he says that it does not, define poetry and prose as different things, for prose could have its own proper looser rhythms and measures. But Shelley goes on to talk about translation. Hence the vanity of translation. It were as wise to cast a violet into a crucible that you might discover the formal principle of its color and odor, as seek to transfuse from one language into another the creations of a poet. The plant must spring again from its seed, or it will bear no flower. And this is the burthen of the curse of Babel. Scientists do cast violets into crucibles and discover the principles of their color and odor. Shelley did not say it was impossible. He said it was unwise. We also translate poetry. And here, with the metaphor of translation, I think I can finally get at what has been worrying me all along. A poem is its words. It may be recreated in a different language, but then it is a new poem, a new plant, as Shelley says, sprung from the idea seed of the old one. You cannot change the words and still have the poem. This is inarguable. But it is also an inarguable fact that many poets delight in translating poetry, and many readers delight in translations. I call John Keats to witness Chapman's Homer in hand. This is a bit of a paradox, but worse, it leads back to the blonde brunette fallacy. Nobody even tries to argue that prose can't be translated. Everybody knows it can. Everybody who can read the original and compare the translation knows what gets lost in translation, and writhes and groans and shouts, "How could the stupid ass miss that?" But still, most of us here read War and Peace in one of the variously inadequate and, we are told, inept translations, and we talk about it quite as if, in fact, we had read War and Peace. And I think we are right to do so. But is a novel not its words, then? If not, what is it? There is not, nor ever was, a real Natasha. Nor is the Napoleon of War and Peace the real Napoleon. Far from it. He is Tolstoy's invention. And a good thing, too. But then, what is a novel, if not a web of words, ideas? Is a novel all ideas? Far from it. And a good thing, too. But let us call the emotions and perceptions and complex apprehensions aroused by a novel ideas, since nobody seems to know what else to call them. Well then, are words and ideas so easily separable in prose? Does an ineffable yet durable idea-ness exist? A Shelleyan idea seed, a soul, immaterial, yet capable of being translated, of being brought across the gap between two languages, cultures, ages, and fitted into a new and totally different word body, without itself undergoing any substantial change or loss. This is metempsychosis, reincarnation. I believe it because I see it happen, but I don't understand it. Because I also believe that a novel, just as much as a poem, is its words. Translation is entirely mysterious. Increasingly, I have felt that the act of writing is itself translating, or more like translating than it is like anything else. What is the other text? The original? I have no answer. I suppose it is the source. The deep sea where ideas swim, and one catches them in nets of words and swings them shining into the boat, where, in this metaphor, they die and get canned and eaten in sandwiches. To bring something across, one needs a boat. Or a bridge. What bridge? The metaphor is all self-destruct. I am left with the stubborn feeling that composition, whether of poetry or prose, is not all that different from translation. In translating, you have a text of words to work from. In composing or creating, you don't. You have a text that is not words, and you find the words. That's a difference, of course. But the job, getting the right words in the right order, getting the measure right, is the same. Feels the same. Perhaps this is why sometimes a lot of writers writing in different languages, in different countries, all seem to be going the same direction without communicating about it. Like a flock of birds or fish, suddenly all doing the same new thing and understanding what the others are trying to do. They are all translating into their own idiom or idiolect from the same nonverbal text. It is also because of this that I feel that the area where Himes, Tedlock, and others have been working, not abstract theories of translation, but actual translations across the widest possible gaps from an oral, performed text in the totally alien language of a radically different culture into written English, that this is where something exciting is going on. This is one of the places where our literature is alive, unfixed, on the move, defying definition. What is this stuff? Is it spoken or written? Both. Is it narrative or ritual? Both. Is it poetry or prose? Both. That's the sort of stuff I want to be able to compose myself. I want to learn how to make translations from the languages nobody knows, nobody speaks. The translations will not be as good as the originals, but then they never are.